the first two talks, we talked about development as being a major factor in the future of the Earth, and the questions of justice and the distinct possibility that it will not be possible for all of the people of the planet, particularly if population growth keeps going on, for all the people of the planet to have a standard of living such as we have in the United States or Western Europe or Japan. And in the third talk, we discussed the advent of nuclear weapons and the very real possibility that with the existing nuclear arsenals of the world, that it would be possible to do so much damage to the life support system of the planet that it would lead to the extinction of the human species. Tonight, I want to try to explain what extinction of the human species means. That's a task that I find somewhat difficult. In fact, I've been working all day on trying to figure out what I would say in 30 minutes on this subject. But what I will talk about is drawn largely from this book, The Fate of the Earth, by Jonathan Schell. I'm sure a number of you have seen it. It was published originally in The New Yorker as a series of three articles. And the second of those three articles is kind of the basis for what I'm going to be talking about tonight, with some modifications and additions and moving things around. What we found in looking at the nuclear arsenals of the world is that depending on how they were used and if they were used in the most destructive manner or if they increase still further, there is a distinct possibility that we could use them to kill somewhere on the order of 5 billion people. Now we think about the deaths associated with the downing of an airliner as being a major disaster, or famine deaths in the Sahel, or the earthquake in Mexico City. But these are tiny, tiny numbers compared with the kinds of or the numbers of deaths that could occur as a result of a nuclear war. Now, one of the things that we discussed last time is that unlike kind of repressive political regimes, where there's a possibility in time of that regime changing, we really have no prospect of getting rid of nuclear weapons. The reason is that unlike kind of a political theory or something of that sort, nuclear weapons are a result of scientific knowledge, something that we don't generally find any way to forget. You could take the weapons apart, but they could be put back together. You could destroy the weapons, but the factories could build them again. The only way, ultimately, in which you can eliminate the knowledge of how to build nuclear weapons is by destroying the people who have that knowledge. That's the only way that we'll ever get rid of them. You know, we are a generation that now lives with the knowledge that the creation that God has given us contains material that has energy within it that can be used to destroy the whole human species. And we're always going to know that. We'll never forget that as a species. We're always going to know that, and we will have to live that way. We won't ever have any other creation to work with. That's a kind of new fact that we have to deal with. The basic information came to us in 1945. But it's only recently that the magnitude of the nuclear arsenals has gotten so large that it is apparent that today, at any moment, the entire species could be extinguished. Now, when you begin to try to think about what this means, Shell uses, a useful metaphor. He talks about the experience of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and the eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And he says, in that act, there was a punishment that followed. And that punishment was the end of immortal life, or immortality, that human beings, at that point, God punished them by saying that you will die, you will have a finite life. Now, since then, we have continued to eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and have now eaten rather deeply. And I'd say, as Shell does, that we now are sentenced to what you might call the second death. And the first death cuts off life. All of our lives are now finite. And death puts an end to that life for each and one, every one of the individuals. The second death, extinction, cuts off births. It puts an end to the birth process. Now, the meaning of extinction is not really to be found in the death of 5 billion individuals. There's a lot of tragedy in that, and a lot of significance in it, of course. But the real meaning of extinction is what the world and the people in that world mean to each and one of us individually. And I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that. The first way in which you can really begin to try to grope with what extinction means is to make the comparison between extinction and death. It's not really possible for us even to really think about our own death, because the closer, we never really live out the death or conscious of the death experience. And if you want to think about what death means, in effect you have to manufacture for yourself a survivor on the other side of death to imagine what death will be after the experience. Now, there's a similar kind of problem in thinking about extinction. And you can imagine how that develops by thinking about larger and larger nuclear attacks. If you have a fairly large nuclear attack, a lot of people get killed. You think about a little larger one, when more people get killed. You get down to the point where there are just a few people who survive. And as you go through this progression, you discover that there's less and less to think about as you go along. And that in that way, it becomes very hard to really find anything to get your mind to hold on to as to what extinction means. But it becomes apparent that extinction is a human future that can never become a present. It's a possibility for us in the future. It can't ever be quite experienced. We all die before that ever happens. So it's not really possible for any of us to imagine really what it would be like to see extinction. And you can, in what you might think of as kind of a coldly scientific frame of mind, imagine an inert scene, a moonscape or something of that sort, as to what extinction means. But I don't find that a very revealing way of thinking about what the vanishing of the human species would mean. Now, another kind of way in which you can go about that, or trying to imagine what it means, is to try to think about it in terms of goodness and badness, of values. And here again, some unexpected kinds of things turn up. In that it's not really possible to say that the end of the world is either good or bad, that the destruction of the human species is good or bad. And the reason you can't say that is that humankind as a species is neither good nor bad. What we really are is something akin to a theater in which good acts and bad acts are acted out. Good lives and bad lives are acted out. But the species as a whole is neither good nor bad. The species is the medium through which good things and bad things happen. You can kind of get a little more sense of this by thinking about a stone. A stone doesn't ever do anything good or bad. You can say the same thing of a tree, or even a deer. The human species, I believe, is the only aspect of creation that really does good or bad. Good or bad is brought to the creation through the acts of human beings. So the loss of the species itself is not either really good or bad, but it eliminates all possibilities for future good or bad. One other thing that you might think about in this connection is that the creation would be missed by God. That Christ would feel that a lot of effort had gone to waste. But there again, you run into this problem that, in effect, to imagine God after the human extinction missing human beings is in a way to kind of surreptitiously or clandestinely inventing a survivor. Because we think of ourselves as being, in total, the body of Christ. And when you destroy the body of Christ, what's left to really miss the human species? All of that has gone. Now, I guess maybe the way to think about this is to say that humankind is not to be thought of as something that possesses a certain worth in and of itself, but as an inexhaustible source of all the possible forms of worth. And if you think of it that way, then it's possible to begin asking questions about who would want to start a nuclear war, a nuclear holocaust. And I think that you could say that it is only a generation of people who believed that they had achieved every possible form of worth. To use Shell's word, I think that Christians might say it's only a generation that was absolutely certain that it had redeemed the earth, that would feel it was then justified in destroying humankind. Because in destroying it, you've removed all possibility of further redemption. You've removed all possibility of any further worth being developed. Of any good taking place. And similarly, I think that it's possible to say that it's only a generation that believes they have not yet fully achieved a redemption has not yet achieved all the good that's possible. It's only that kind of a mental attitude that is going to be a sufficient and compelling reason to try to prevent the extinction of the species. Now, while we can argue that there's nothing inherently good or bad about the demise of the human species, yet there's something there that looks like an awful lot of murders, and we know that murders are not good. And by thinking about an extension of murder to genocide to extinction, there may be a way in which we can begin to get some further sense about the meaning of extinction. And to do this, it's helpful to develop the concept of what Schell and Anna Arendt have called the common world. And I put this up on the board here as a little diagram with past generations on one side, present generations in the middle, and future generations off to the right. The common world is all of that. The common world is all that you inherit when you're born. It's the history, it's the institutions, it's the knowledge, it's the art, it's the science, it's the love, it's the associations, it's all of the things that link past generations, the present, and on to the future generations. The significance of the common world is really great. It is probably true that the human species is the only species in which the members of the species, the individuals, all know that they must die. And the only reason we're really able to know that is that through the common world that we have created, we're able to imagine the future generations, and knowing that we will not be a part of that is, in a sense, the knowledge of our that we will die. Now, each generation, as it comes along, receives and holds and transmits the inheritance of the past generations, and transmits that to future generations. And the biggest bit of inheritance that we inherit in the common world is the ecosystem itself, and of course the most important part of that, if you want to think of it that way, is the human species itself. Now, when you begin thinking about this extension from murder to genocide to extinction, that progression, we know that there is a crime of murder, that there is something evil about that. But what crime, what name can we attach to the crime of extinction? We have no word for that. We don't have anything equivalent to a murderer. For the crime of genocide, we refer to war criminals. And even there's a complicating kind of factor with war criminals, because in a sense, we don't even know how to punish a war criminal. People who have struggled with the meaning of war crimes and with an appropriate punishment for war crimes have come up with the term radical evil as a means of describing what a war crime is. And as you analyze their description of it, particularly in the context of this notion of the common world, and common here means, it's a point I missed, but it's it's the world that we hold in common with the past and the present and the future generations. It's the things that link us all, that build ties among them. And that's in that sense that we mean it's common. But as you think about radical evil in this context, it seems that this is a crime that goes beyond destroying individual victims, in whatever numbers that may be, and in addition, mutilates or destroys the world that can in some way respond to in a sense then be in some measure redeem the deaths that occur through the war crime. Now, that begins to give you some understanding of how extinction and war crimes might be linked together. Because in both cases, they are attacks on the future inherently. In the case of war crimes that we have seen, they're attacks on cultural heritage or a particular genotype of Jews, for example. But in some cases, other types of people. I think it's fair to say that Stalin was engaged in genocide for a time, and certainly Pol Pot, in my view, was. But there's an attack on that effort to make the past heritage available to the present generation to pass on to the future generation. Not just to kill people, but to try to destroy an aspect of the common world. And that's really what happens as you get to extinction. And another way in which you can kind of begin to get the connection between genocide and extinction is to think about the nature of a nuclear holocaust. What the superpowers intend to do if a nuclear holocaust breaks out is to commit genocide against each other. That's basically what it's about. To the degree that you can really begin to get a feel of what extinction is about, it relates to the common world. It relates to our ability to pass on as a current generation, the things we have learned from the past, our religion, our history, everything, is that's not a possibility for future generations. And we simply can't pass that on. Now, a question might arise, and I think it's a helpful question, as to who experiences extinction. Future generations don't suffer from extinction. They never feel it. Now, there's 5 billion people who would feel the agony of death. But future generations don't suffer from extinction. They're simply locked out of that experience of life altogether. Now, we can imagine we can draw closer to death. We can imagine ourselves getting closer and closer to death, but never quite arriving, because at the moment of death, we aren't anymore. And just as we are about to arrive at death, we're gone. And like death, extinction is not felt when it arrives, but it's really only felt beforehand in the foreknowledge that we have of its possibility, of its pending approach. So when it comes to the question of who experiences extinction, maybe the only real answer to that is the living, the people now, are the people who really experience extinction. And if that's the case, then you have to ask, well, what does extinction do to us? How do we experience extinction? How are we feeling it? And I think that the answer to that let's see if I can read my notes here. Yes, is that the way in which we experience it is through all human activities that assume that there's going to be a human future. And we can think of a number of these, I'm sure. I've got three types of things listed here. The first has to do with anything in which biological renewal is involved. If we're living on the assumption of being able to reproduce, being able to have children, any and every aspect of that is threatened and is made meaningless by the prospect of extinction. Love, childbirth, desire between the sexes, that all becomes largely, totally meaningless. You can think, for example, of a wedding. When you go to a wedding, the people involved are in effect making a statement to the whole of the society and to the church. The statement is that their love is such that they're willing, they're committed to creating a home environment that's suitable for the rearing of children. And everyone who attends the wedding, in effect, is there saying, we think this is important, that there be an environment in which children can be reared and educated, values communicated, religion taught. And when you're faced with the prospect of extinction, of all of that going away, it makes the whole process of marriage a rather meaningless one. It also creates this, you might say, poor soil for love itself to exist. The very thought that the human future is not sure anymore makes it less of a hospitable place in which simply to try to build and maintain the kind of relationships that keep a marriage together. You can begin to get a little bit of a sense of what this might mean by thinking about extinction coming about in a slow process. If there were some way through sterilization or whatever to completely eliminate all possibility of future births, but yet without killing everybody, tubal ligations and vasectomies for the entire 5 billion population of the world. Now what would it be like then to live in that situation? You know, people would begin to die, there'd be no births, the population would begin to go down, and I think as time went on, the idea of love, of relation between the sexes would cease to have any real significant meaning. And quite possibly, before it all ended, people would begin taking their own lives. It reminds me of, in a way, of that novel by Neville Shute, On the Beach, that was written a number of years ago, in which finally the last few people did take their lives. Another kind of link that you can see here between these things is the use of the word obscene to describe both pornography and a nuclear holocaust. And when you think about the meaning of that word, an aspect of it is that pornography is seen to be a debasing, a removal of all kind of genuine human attachment from desire and leaving nothing of any real redeeming social value. The same thing is true of nuclear war, in that there is an aspect of violence that has now developed that simply has no redeeming social value to it. And in that way, you can see a connection between these two things. Another aspect of the common world that we would miss, and that we miss right now, and it is impacted right now at the project, is politics. In one way or another, whenever politicians speak, the thing that they're talking to us about is making a better world for our children. And it makes a real lie out of the whole thing, a real hypocrisy, if, in fact, we know that there is ahead the prospect of simply destroying any possibility of there even being children in the future. It also looks very strange and kind of hypocritical for government officials, on the one hand, to be trying to create a better world for our children, and on the other hand, taking actions and steps that simply threaten the existence of all children in the future. So in that way, the prospect of extinction really has a profound effect on politics. It also has an impact on institutions, particularly when you find institutions that are simply unable and unaware or unwilling to deal with what is certainly the most significant threat to human civilization altogether. A third area in the common world in which we have experience of extinction right now is that having to do with works of art, with history, and thought. And the whole purpose of art and history and works of thought, of science, of all kinds, is in a way to be in communion with or in communication with previous generations and future generations. It's the means by which art, for example, is the means by which some of the feelings of past generations are passed on to us. And if there's a prospect, as we do face, that there will be no future generations to experience, to communicate with our own art, with our own writing, with our own history, it becomes a rather meaningless kind of exercise. It loses a lot of the excitement about participating in these activities. And you can see that in a way in a new development in art, where there is this thing that is called the happening, where the art itself, the experience, the event of the creation is the art. There's no intent to preserve anything after the event itself, after the happening, with the feeling, the expectation, perhaps, that there will never be an audience well into the future to appreciate it. Now that's one more aspect of how extinction has an impact on us living today. I think it's possible to say that of all the crimes against the future, extinction is the greatest. In a way, it's what you might call the murder of the future. It's the termination of the future for everyone. And with the Holocaust, the survivors have said repeatedly that there's an obligation never to forget. And now, as you think about a crime against the future and ask who is to never forget the prospect of extinction, and I think you have to say that it is us. It is those who live before extinction who have to bear the responsibility of never forgetting That's been transferred to us. It can't be future generations. And it's we who are going to have to be the ones who either commit the crime of extinction or prevent it. And it's we who are going to have to bear the witness and remember and to arrive at the judgment of the crime. Now, there are, I'd say, a few things that go with this new experience that we have of living with extinction as a possibility, that are some benefits, some joys. And one of these has to do, in a way, with the fact that the unborn can't feel extinction, but it can feel something else, and that is that it can feel survival. There's kind of a new idea here, and that is the idea of escaping extinction before you're born. For future generations now, for all future generations, their existence will depend on the wisdom and the restraint of a long succession of generations before them, of which we're the first of those generations. And to understand the idea of the kind of joy and appreciation that future generations can have for us, put yourselves in the shoes of someone in the future who exists precisely because we allowed them to be born, that we found ways to prevent extinction from occurring. That's, I think, a way in which there's a great possibility of joy. The fact is that the future is no longer something that we can simply take for granted. It has been. But survival now, in a sense, in a very real sense, is an act. We have to create each day as we go along by taking the steps necessary to see that a nuclear holocaust or some other form of extinction doesn't occur. Now, in the past, the future was just a given to us. Now we have to achieve it. It has to be created as we go along. And the nuclear peril has one other kind of benefit for us, and that is that whether or not we individually have children of our own, the prospect of the nuclear holocaust, the nuclear peril that we face, makes us all parents of future generations. And I think there's a kind of joy in knowing that we have to take some responsibility for the creation of the future, and that it's possible if we'll, as we were talking about in the Bible study class today, put on the full armor and resist death. I mean, this is death in the extreme. You can think of it in terms of the principalities and powers. But as Don was saying this morning, the thing that we must be prepared to do when we put on the full armor is to stand like a defiant three-year-old in front of a giant principality and power, simply put out the hand and say no. Say no to death. That, I think, is the thing that we must do now. Well, I have done the best I can here to describe to you what extinction means. And I have to say, I find this is the first time I've ever tried to talk about this. You know, many of the other things I've talked about, I've talked about before, but this is kind of a new effort on my part to try to pull all this stuff together in a short talk. So I'll stop there and see what questions and comments and reactions you have. And maybe some of you have got thoughts as well as to what it means.
In terms of extinction of the species, killing 5 billion people, if you miss 1,000, how long does it take to get it back? So you detonated all the nuclear weapons.
Well, if we're talking about a nuclear holocaust, the chances of 5,000 people ever recovering is not good because of the extensive damage that would be done to the whole ecosystem. Probably the most severe would be damage to the upper atmosphere. There'd be so much soot, smoke, and dust put in that it would block out sunlight and substantially reduce the temperature of the planet for an extended period of time, perhaps a year or more.
It's surface temperature.
Surface temperature,
but
that's right.
Subterranean, it doesn't change much.
Well, subterranean, not much. But if you come back out after a year, what will have changed is that the ozone layer will be largely gone. And being outside, even short periods of time, would badly burn the retina. And while you and I could wear sunglasses or something to protect our eyes, we'd still get skin cancers in large quantities. And animals are not going to be in a position to do that. They'll be blind. The whole ecosystem would be vastly disrupted in that way. The ultraviolet light also does enormous damage to the plants. And there's, I think, very good reason to think that either the real cold that would come for a period of a year or the ultraviolet light that would exist afterward would create such a hostile environment that I think it's very unlikely that there would be any survivors anywhere on the planet.
How long
yes,
does it
sir.
Go ahead. Do you know how long it takes the ozone layer to come back?
It takes a long time. I mean, it's
thousands of years.
Well, it would depend a lot on how much. In part, the ozone layer is created by chemical activities, maintained in part by chemical activities on the planet. And it depends, you know, how much damage has been done to the other parts of it as to how long it would take. But it would be decades, I'd say, before it would come back. Yes?
Not sure how clearly I'm thinking at this hour of the evening, but...
I know the problem.
Part of what I heard you saying was a very rational, kind of philosophical discussion, and I understand why you took that approach, but it seems to me that rather than someone pushing the button and creating the Holocaust, it's most likely to happen through denial and through a kind of craziness that would mount out of fear or out of anger, and would not have any logic involved in it at all. And if you follow that kind of thought, then I think we're in even more danger. Because the process of somebody logically thinking through the way you were in terms of, you know, well, we've achieved everything now, that would be the only logical way it could happen. When you look at what Reagan has done, even in terms of indebting the debt creation for future generations in this country by essentially denying the effects of the economic policies. That's just a minor kind of thing, but the denial is so perverse and so pervasive in some of our political leaders that that's the part of it that scares me.
That's a very real reason to be fearful. But I think it's not just political leaders. I think each and every one of us has got some possibility of denial in us as well.
But I just think that when you put somebody, one of the arguments about Nixon for a long time was you take an average person and you give them that kind of power, or they create that kind of power politically, they're not up to handling it in a sense.
Yeah,
they got to create all the hit lists of the people who might get them.
Yeah, Gary, I was having a hard time at the beginning trying to figure out where you were going, but toward the end it became very clear, and I'll just relate an experience I had with my son that illustrates, I think, partly what you were saying. Just the possibility of extinction, if I heard you correctly, in fact, has changed all of us, or certainly can and should. And what I realized is that maybe our children, at least in this particular circumstance, it was my son, who was about 10 years old, are more aware of this than maybe a lot of the adults in some ways.
That's right.
My son came in to me and he sat down and he said, "Dad, what would happen if an atomic bomb landed on New York?" And I said, "Well, it would destroy New York. It would kill all the people in New York." And he said, "Well, could it reach me?" And I thought about that for a while, and I said, "Well, it might. You're going to get some fallout. I don't know." And I wasn't quite sure. And so he proceeded. He marched from New York to Colorado, to Albuquerque, asking the same question. You know, and I was really shocked for a while that he was asking the questions, but he's 9 years old, to where of the destruction, wants to know what it's about, it's impacting his life already.
One of my sons has told me that he doesn't expect to live to be 30 years old. No, very seriously. And someone else here in this room told me the story about being just 11 years old and being so worried about nuclear Holocaust that with a friend developed plans for having a secret hiding home in Antarctica, solar heated, wind powered, so forth, as a way to escape. You know, it does weigh on the minds of our children.
But you know, I was in high school when the first bomb went off in Bikini, over the atoll there, and I was aware that I was afraid from 13 years old on, very conscious and very afraid, and never thought I would grow up. And so I think there's a whole generation of us that are, well, I'm 51 now, have gone through that same kind of thing.
And I think, well, all children from now on are going to have to go through that.
Yeah.
And it would be good if we could find ways of helping them with that, you know, to have better answers than you and I have had to that kind of thing. But in a way, we're, you and I and everyone here is now in a way a part of this generation, a part of this new group of people that are going to inhabit the planet, that can be thankful to people who've lived before us that they didn't blow the place up. You know, I think that's we're beginning to be able to understand what that means. Yeah. Yeah, let's get this one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess just a comment. One's kind of a quotable quote from Augustine with regard to your notion of the future, and I think that rings very true. Augustine once said that what people hope for in the future determines what they practice in the present. And if we grow up, if you will, not even hoping for a future, you know, we are already experiencing extinction,
yeah,
because that's determining what we are now practicing.
Exactly.
In the present. And I think particularly in terms of, well, cultural narcissism, the me generation, the stress on immediacy, those despairing thoughts, we'll never make it till 30, a couple of 2 years ago in the New York Times, the sociologist John Alexander interviewed college students about that kind of understanding and what that meant for the American dream. And he said, you can paraphrase it in one sentence. What it meant now is that students, when they graduate from college, hope to, one, get rich, two, get laid, three, get even. Very cynical view. Mm-hmm. But if there's no future, cynicism seems to be a good operating category. Now the question, and that's, I'm not quite sure, Jerry, about what you said in the beginning of your presentation and your conclusion about species in itself is neither good nor bad. I'm not quite sure how that follows in terms of then saying, but we need that future, and if you will, because without future and past and present, that whole common world, you know, we experience extinction. Doesn't that presuppose some kind of value that species in itself is good or bad, that there is some notion of intrinsic goodness in things?
Well,
now maybe I misunderstood you there, but that one.
I had the same problem.
I'm not.
I have the same problem too. I'm not sure that I fully understand that argument, and but I have to say this is not original work, and I'm in a way have to give credit and blame to Jonathan Schell on this. But as best I can understand, the point is that we certainly need the present generation always. I mean, that's critically important. But the species as such is, well, let's see, how do I want to put this? I think that what he's trying to do is make a distinction between the species and the collection of individuals that represent the species at any one particular point in time. And to say that the collection of individuals that are there are the means through which good and evil appear on the planet. And that the species itself is something more abstract than that. And that the more abstraction, the more abstract entity, the species itself, is, as he puts it, more like the theater in which good and evil appear. And it appears through the individual members of the species rather than the species per se.
So as you understand Schell there, he's using good and bad as a moral category, and a moral category which can only be applied to individuals and not to and not corporately or structurally?
That's how I would understand it. But the paragraph in which it's discussed is brief, and I think it's ambiguous, and it's a point, I think, on which Christians might have, or some Christians would have some disagreement because of the notion that human beings are inherently evil. And so, yeah.
Well, you take Genesis.
But, yeah, let's get this one first, and then we'll get Connie's and come back to yours. Try and give.
One thing I find very disturbing about this is a fundamentalist religion with a very apocalyptic viewpoint that this is God's will that we blow ourselves
yes.
up. And so this is sort of inculcated into a religious doctrine that seems to be fairly strong.
That's true, and I brought with me an article in which a journalist kind of gathered all the information about Reagan's born-again views about the apocalypse, and apparently he has told people that he believes that the apocalypse will be a nuclear holocaust, and you know, tied in with all of that is the desire of the politically active religious right to have a born-again Christian who believes that the Armageddon will be a nuclear holocaust, with that born-again value controlling the prospect for nuclear war. And I have to say I'm right with you in finding that extremely frightening. Connie.
I was just going to comment on Michael's comment about hopes for the future. With children, the things that I've read that have addressed the idea of fear of nuclear war have said that the more you can work with your kids to help them feel that they do have some fate over the future, the less they will fear and assume that their future is going to end in something like nuclear holocaust. And I guess that I see in my own kids that same fear existing for other environmental problems too, at least my kids, and I'm sure others are aware of problems like population explosion and pollution and degradation of the ozone layer at a very young age. And I think that that's maybe a real reason for the church to get on the ball and start talking about the environment, helping people to feel that they can act in this world to save their own lives in the future, to bring Christ's kingdom in terms of a healthy creation, and to do it now, not wait for, not wait till we start seeing these problems becoming more evident. And then a second comment I had, just listening to you, and this is just a comment, I myself was faced with a very serious health problem a few years ago, and when faced with my own death, the problems, the feelings that I felt were so similar on a microcosm to what you described with Extinction of the Humans, I just had to say that. I think that when you come up front with the idea of your own life ending, the thought that is most horrifying is somehow that all of your experiences, which are so rich to you, are going to come to an end without having given them to someone else is what's most horrifying. And that's possibly what prompts people to write or to do some artistic work towards the end of their life to somehow pass on this richness to the next generation. And what you were describing was the same thing but expanded to the human race. That was very nice in that way.
Yeah, thank you.
I guess I would encourage you to adapt at the beginning of it a biblical base of and creation is good. That mankind, peoplekind, humankind is good.
Okay.
Drop that, because I think philosophically the man is not Christian. And while I don't have anything against him for that, I think it does not offer hope. What I was getting so clear about in your presentation was how hopeless the philosophy behind it was.
Well, I want to conclude here in just a second, but two comments. One is that I think you and Mike would come out advising me exactly the opposite as to how I should begin if I'm going to reflect properly Christian thought about the moral nature of the human species. And I think that is, in fact, something on which there's still a lot of confusion in the church. And next week, when I begin talking about how I think the church can and should be responding to this whole collection of things that I've been talking about, that issue is going to come up as part of the discussion. One final thing in response to Connie is to just relate the story of a mathematician whose name I can't remember at the moment, but he was a French mathematician who was challenged to a duel and found himself in the same situation that you were. All right. And he started a letter to a friend in which he poured out all of the ideas that he had about future mathematics that he would want to do and share with other generations. That letter has been a gold mine of ideas for mathematicians ever since. There are still conjectures and hypotheses in that letter that have been neither proved nor disproved, but dozens of PhD theses have emerged from that one letter that was written, because, as you were saying, there's a whole lot of experience and wealth and ideas want to pass on before before dying.
You know, and the punchline, he was 20 when he wrote it.
Yeah. 20 when he wrote the letter and died the next day. Well, let's adjourn formally now. There's a few more minutes before Vespers, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to talk with you.